to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas. This evening we bring you Cryptic Delphic, Climate Conversation, and Taste of Home. Enjoy.
Welcome back to the final segment of the semester of Cryptic Delphic with me, Mel. It's been really fun talking to you guys about murder mystery, conspiracy, and all things horror. I will be back next semester with new content. And for this episode, I decided to focus on horror movies of the decade, how horror has changed. Because, you know, the decade's over, the horror movies have been coming out, and all these different type of horror movies are just really interesting to see the changes within the genre itself. So we're just going to go back in time to 2010, and we're going to start with Black Swan. So Black Swan is a psychological horror film. It stars Natalie Portman, Mila Kunis, and Winona Ryder. It's about a girl named Nina, who's a ballerina. She gets the chance to play the White Swan, Princess Odette, in this production of what's it called? Why did the word leave my mouth?
Swan Lake.
Thank you. I don't know why I left my brain. I was like, he has a swan. So she finds herself slipping into madness when Thomas, the artistic director, decides that Lily might fit the role better. And Lily's played by Mila Kunis and Nina's played by Natalie Portman. This movie really delves into psychological type madness that goes in your brain. During this time, we had a very different series of movies. We were really into comedy horror. We were also into a lot of the psychological horror, like Orphan, for instance, which came out in 2009. So it's interesting to see that we still have psychological horror being very trendy. As I mentioned, we also had comedy horror being trendy. We had Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which was directed by Ellie Craig, and it's about these two well-meaning hillbillies who are mistaken by killers by a group of clueless college students. This comedy horror was still very in, especially in the 2000s. We saw like parodies of scary movies. So we were just very into that trend still, but we start leaning away from that as the years go on. We also have the start of a franchise, and that is Insidious. Insidious is a story that centers on a couple whose son inexplicably enters a comatose state and becomes a vessel for ghosts in an astral dimension who want to inhabit his body. We don't really see a lot of franchises during this time. We had like really successful franchises in the past, like Saw, for instance, but we didn't really have any other successful franchise in the horror industry. So Insidious is one of the very first ones in 2010, and we start seeing more franchises appear as the years go on. So for 2010, I mentioned Black Swan, Insidious, and Tucker and Dale versus Evil. So 2011 was a very interesting year for horror because there was actually not a lot of horror movies being developed. We have The Cabin in the Woods, which is another American horror comedy film. We were still very much into the comedy aspect of horror. It starred Kristen Connolly, Chris Hemsworth, Anna Hutchinson, Fran Kranz, Jesse Williams, and Bradley Whitford. The movie is really interesting. It centers around five college friends who are in a remote cabin, and then the zombie apocalypse breakout happens, and then they have to basically survive. And then there's these two other scientists who decide that they created the zombie thing, and they just wanted to realize like what would happen if we have a zombie type outbreak with these five kids, like an experiment of some sort. It's a very interesting movie, but we start really, comedy horror is not really as popular as it was, so people really wanted something different. We also have Scream 4, which is the final installment in the Scream film series. This movie was about Sydney, who would visit her hometown after 10 long years. She catches up with her old friends. Her return not only brings back memories, but also beckons the return of Ghostface. So this is the final installment in the Scream series. Scream series was a very popular franchise that was created in the 90s, 2000s. So it's just very interesting to see that that franchise ended. But when we move on to 2012, we see that there is a really big change because franchises start becoming very popular. So 2011, I talked about The Cabin in the Woods and Scream 4. So 2012 is an interesting time because this is when one of the most popular franchises came out, and that was the Avengers movie. everyone, I'm pretty sure, knows, like, the Avengers, the superhero movies, became super popular. That franchise basically took over the box office. So scary movies weren't really watched during this time. We have Sinister, which was a film that basically discussed about a true crime writer who wanted to create a new book but didn't really have any ideas. So he found out a story about this family that lived in a house, and he wanted to investigate what happened in that house. So he decides, why don't I just move me and, like, the rest of my family into this house so we can all discover what's in it. And of course, the family kind of has all these horrific things happen to them. So it's a very interesting movie. I found this one to be really good. We also have cartoon horror again. Since 2009, we had Coraline, which was a very successful horror type movie, and it was targeted towards children, but adults enjoyed it as well. We had Paranorman, which was produced by Laika, the same company, I believe, that did Coraline. It was a stop motion animated series, it's an animated movie, and it's about Norman, who was a resident of a town. The town is affected by a curse, and Norman, who has this unique ability to see these ghosts and such, he decides, why don't I try to save the town and figure out what this curse really is about. So yeah, it was a very successful movie, and it also included an LGBTQ character, which wasn't really seen in the horror genre for a long time. It was never really discussed about or spoken about in the horror genre. So seeing an LGBTQ character and in a cartoon where kids will also be watching as well is very huge, and it's a step in the right direction towards horror, including diversity and all this inclusion. We also have Prometheus, which was a science fiction film. Science fiction films were really outdated during this time, and they decided to try to make a comeback with the whole alien invasion type storyline. So after a clue to mankind's origins is discovered, explorers are sent to the darkest corner of the universe. Their different expectations take a toll on them when they find something unimaginable. So once again, science fiction was not really super popular, but it was interesting to see that during this year, when they saw that the franchises were very focused on superheroes and science, they decided, let's try something similar. Let's try science. Let's try humans going out into space and discovering new things. And it was interesting to see that throwback. So 2012, it was Sinister, Paranorman, and Prometheus that I discussed. So 2013, we start having franchises in the horror community, and it's very interesting because these franchises actually become like one of the most successful franchises in the horror genre, and that is The Conjuring and The Purge. The Conjuring was the first movie of the Conjuring Universe franchise, and this franchise is a very complicated franchise because it branches out into multiple movies and multiple areas of subjects, such as Annabelle the Doll and The Nun, which I will get to in just a moment. The Conjuring is also interesting because it focuses on Ed and Lorraine Warren. So the Perrin family moves into a farmhouse where they experience supernatural phenomenon. So they contact the Warrens to get rid of the evil entity haunting them. We also have The Purge, which is also a family that is experiencing difficulty in America. You see, the thing is, America during this time is basically like a dystopian America where you cannot do any crime, but on one specific day called The Purge, they make crime legal. So basically anyone can commit murder, can steal, can vandalize, etc., and it's all completely fine just for those selected hours. So this family decides like they're going to protect themselves, but they get themselves into trouble when they're holding hostage a murderer during The Purge. So yeah, these two franchises become very popular, and the names basically come up again as the years go by. During 2013, we also had Oculus, which was a very successful supernatural psychological horror film. And basically this movie was about two siblings who are struggling to rebuild their relationship. And one of the siblings suspects that their antique mirror, known as the Lazar Glass, is behind the tragedy. The seemingly harmless reflections contain a supernatural force that inflicts the mind of anyone who gazes into it. As Kaylee gets closer to the truth, the siblings become caught in the mirror's evil spells. And that is very interesting as well, because once again, we see the sci-fi elements, the supernatural elements that become very popular during this time, thanks to the other franchises that are popping up. We have other superhero movies becoming very popular, and they involve supernatural science and unexplained phenomenon. So that just starts reflecting in horror as well. So the 2013 movies that I mentioned were Oculus, The Conjuring, and The Purge. 2014 is very interesting because we start seeing more indie horror films. We start seeing films that aren't made by popular studios and they're more low budget, but they do more successful. And one of them is being The Babadook, which was an Australian psychological horror film about a mother who is plagued by the violent death of her husband, battles with her son's fear of a monster lurking in the house, but soon discovers a sinister presence all around her. So once again, indie horror films start becoming super popular. There was a lot of good reviews on The Babadook, and as the years go on, we start seeing more indie style films start popping up by more lesser known production studios, and it just becomes very super popular, which I will get into in 2015-2016. But we also see films that involve the world around us and things that are not supernatural but more our bodies. That being an example of It Follows. It Follows was a movie basically discussing sexual intercourse. Basically, it's about a girl named Jay who for the first time learns that she is the latest recipient of a fatal curse that is passed from a victim via sexual intercourse. Death, Jay learns, will creep inexplorably towards her as either a friend or a stranger. Jay's friends don't believe her seemingly paranoid ravings until they too begin to see the phantom assassins and band together to help her flee or defend herself. So this movie is interesting because a trend of involving our senses or the world around us start becoming super popular in horror movies. We start seeing movies that involve like don't see, don't smell, don't touch, don't have sex. Like we have all these different movies that start popping up, and it's very interesting to see that shift of involving the world around us instead of like a supernatural force. We also have movies like Annabelle, which is also in the Conjuring universe. John and Mia are attacked by a couple who are worshippers of Satan. However, before the cops kill them, the couple use a doll to conduit as a conduit to make John and Mia's life miserable. That movie was very successful, and it started a series of Annabelle movies separate from the Conjuring franchise. And we also have As Above, So Below, which I found was a very interesting movie because it used an old tactic of using a video camera to record. We haven't seen that since The Blair Witch Project, Paranormal Activity. So it was very interesting to see that they used a camera, and you're basically just seeing the camera footage. That is the whole point of the movie. There's these explorers and archaeologists who go down to the catacombs and record their findings, realizing that they find a cult. So it's very interesting to see that throwback to the 2000s with the camera usage. So 2014, we have The Babadook, As Above, So Below, It Follows, in Annabelle. So 2015, we start having like investigation type mystery films, and also indie films basically just become super popular. We have The Witch, which discusses a Parisian family setting up a farm at the edge of the woods, and they say a witch lives there and all these strange paranormal things happen. This film was done very beautifully, in my personal opinion, because it had that really nice indie aesthetic, and it basically was kind of like an example of what an indie horror film would, like all the indie horror films would become later on as the years progress. We also have The Wailing, which is a South Korean supernatural film, and this movie was about a series of murders that create the arrival of a mysterious stranger, and he kind of starts investigating the murders and he tries to figure out what's going on. This movie was also in the indie style as well. And South Korean horror movies also become super popular as the years go by. And finally, we have The Invitation, which is also done in the indie style. While attending a dinner family at his former house, a man starts to believe that his ex-wife and her new husband have sinister plans for their guests. This movie, as I said, was also done in a very indie style. It involves masks. It involves a type of filter while you're watching the film. So it was very interesting to see that all these horror creators kind of involved the same elements during this year. So I mentioned The Witch, The Wailing, and The Invitation in 2015. So 2016 was a very successful year for horror, and basically onwards, 2016 onward is just very successful for horror. We have 10 Cloverfield Lane, which was a psychological horror film that involves a woman named Michelle who finds herself in a bunker with Howard, a stranger who informs her that she is safe with him and the world outside is inhabitable. Left dazed, she decides to escape and figure out what's really going on. It's interesting because once again we see that this film is involving the world around us. It's not involving a supernatural entity. identity, which is kind of becoming what it's kind of what movies in America are kind of starting to develop into, just involving the world around us. We also have Hush, which didn't do well commercially, but it's the first time we see that a person is involving their senses in a horror movie, and that is, it involves a deaf person who has a mass killer in her house. So we have this idea of the senses being our only thing to help us, and we're going to start seeing that become a super popular trend in horror movies in the future. We also have Train to Busan, which is one of the most successful Korean horror movies. It is a zombie movie about a man and his daughter on a train to Busan, and they're on their way to see his wife, but the journey becomes a nightmare when they are trapped amidst a zombie outbreak in South Korea. Zombies have been done before. We've seen zombies, especially in The Walking Dead, which is a very popular American TV show. So I feel like zombies are so overdone, but this movie did it really differently, and it refreshed the idea of zombies in horror. And it's a very good film. I recommend it. So 2016, I mentioned Hush, 10 Cloverfield Lane, and Train to Busan. So 2017, we get some of the most successful horror movies of the decade, and one of them is It Chapter One, which is comedy horror. It's interesting because we haven't seen comedy horror in a long time. We kind of shifted away from that, but It Chapter One was kind of like a tribute to comedy horror, and it was done very well. It is a story about seven children who are forced to face their worst nightmares when Pennywise, a shape-shifting clown, reappears. The clown lives in the sewers and targets small innocent children. It's very interesting to see these comical horror elements. The movie did really well, and it was based off the Stephen King novel, for those of you who are into horror novels as well. It did really well, and it was super successful. We also have Jordan Peele's first movie, Get Out, which was also very successful and also very political. Chris, an African-American man, decides to visit his Caucasian girlfriend's parents during a weekend getaway. Although they seem normal at first, he is not prepared to experience the horrors ahead. This movie was very political. It did super well, and it created a good reputation for Jordan Peele, as many other people anticipated more movies from him in the future. We also have Happy Death Day, where college student Teresa continues to relive the day when she was killed to discover the identity of her murder. We have It Comes at Night, where two families are forced to share a home from an uneasy alliance to keep the outside evil at bay. Mother, which is a movie about a woman who her husband invites a family in to live with them, only for her husband to have actually known that family, and they are all involved in a cult, and she just didn't know, and it just kind of starts creating all these horrors. And Veronica, which is a Spanish movie about it's based off of a true story. It's about a girl who basically she does the Ouija board under her school, and she tries to contact her father, but instead contacts a spirit and becomes the portal to this world. So these movies, what they all have in common is Veronica, Mother, and It Comes at Night are in a very indie style. It was all created in the same filter, the same involving of a entity that is from the outside world. And it's just a good shift because honestly, 2018, it involves the outside world so much that all the movies kind of share the same plot, but in a different way, which is kind of interesting. So 2018 is, we have A Quiet Place and Bird Box, which is basically the same plot, but just different. A Quiet Place is a family struggling for survival, where most humans have been killed by blind, but noise-sensitive creatures, so they are forced to communicate in sign language to keep the creatures at bay. So basically that movie is Don't Make a Sound. And Bird Box is, if you see it, you die. So the family involved has to blindfold themselves to get to this destination, which is safe, so that it involves our senses. They're very similar plot-wise, and that those type of movies just become super popular in 2018. We also have Annihilation, which is about a scientist who goes into Area X, which is a sinister and mysterious phenomenon that is expanding across the American coastline. So once she's inside, she's looking for her missing husband. She discovers that the outside world is very dangerous, and It threatens both her and her sanity. This movie involves the mind, and it's very interesting because at first we had the senses, but now we're having a movie that looks into our own selves and our own minds and who we are as a human. So that's very psychological, and it's a very interesting change in the horror movie genre as a whole because we've never really seen that before done in a sci-fi matter. We also have Hereditary, and this is by the studio A24, who become very popular in the horror genre. This is a well-known studio, A24. They are very indie and they do horror pretty well, I have to admit. So this movie is about the Graham family who their grandmother passes away, and her daughter and grandchild begin to unravel cryptic and increasingly terrifying secrets about their ancestry, trying to outrun the sinister fate they have inherited. This movie was very well spoken about. It was all over social media. It did well, and it was a good movie for the A24 production studio, and it gave them a good name in the horror community as a whole.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Cryptic Delphic on AUP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:20.
So 2019, we had some pretty good horror movies this year. We got the final chapter to It, Chapter 2. Basically, the Losers Club were back, and they returned 27 years to the town of Derry, Maine, where Pennywise is once again wreaking havoc and causing all this drama. So they decide, let's conquer our worst fears and just destroy the clown once and for all. This movie was done very well as well, and it included the comedy elements, which was so refreshing to see because honestly we haven't seen that in a long time since the first Chapter 1 It movie. So it was really good to see that because it honestly does comedy and makes horror so well. We also had Midsommar, which was also by A24. It was interesting to see that they not only included horror in the evening, but also included horror in the daylight, which is something we don't see often. Normally when we see the dark, we think, oh, so there's something scary there. But this movie had scary things happening in broad daylight, so that meant, you know, it could happen at any moment. This movie was about a couple that travels to Sweden to visit their friend's rural hometown for its fabled Midsommar Festival. But what begins as an idyllic retreat quickly evolves into an increasingly violent and bizarre competition at the hands of a pagan cult. This movie did really well. It involved the Swedish culture, and that was something also very interesting because we actually saw research of a different kind of like country. I also noticed when I was watching this film that it was very similar to The Wicker Man, which was a 90s movie. If you haven't seen that movie, I would recommend watching it if you liked Midsommar as well, because it was super identical and the plot was similar. Like, it's extremely similar. And that movie was also very interesting. So we also had Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which was a childhood tribute. The Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was a book that many kids in America, I believe, have read. I know I've read it, and I love that book so much. And Guillermo del Toro, he is a master when it comes to getting creepy things into his films. It was a very interesting movie. It's about this girl who basically writes in her book all these different monsters, and whatever you write kind of comes to life, and these kids get a hold of this book and just write out all the things they're afraid of, and it starts coming to life, and they have to stop that before the town gets covered in monsters, basically. So it's very interesting to see that they are including this childhood book that we grew up with now becoming a movie. And it also reminded me of Death Note in the way of like writing something and then that happens. If you guys haven't seen Death Note, I recommend it. It's a really good horror anime, and it's very similar to the idea of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I thought the idea was quite similar. We also have Jordan Peele's second movie, Us, which did really well, and it was about a family who become terrorized by themselves, basically, and it was very psychological in the idea that you're just being attacked by yourself, and you have to discover who you are to find out what's going on. So yeah, we had in 2019, It Chapter 2, Midsommar, Us, and yeah. So now I'm going to get into how horror has changed. We see that there's no more supernatural entities being involved as much. It can basically involve anyone. Anyone can be affected, not just people living in a haunted house. We also see that we are being introduced to elements in the outside world. We start using our senses more in horror movies for survival, and we start kind of trying to see like who we really are as in person, who the people around us are, and how, and if those people are really helping us or if they are affecting us. We also had a reboot of 80s, 2000s horrors and elements such such as It, for instance, with the comedy horror. We had Sci-Fi, and we just had like a kind of like a kind of like a tribute to indie as well. And we start seeing an involvement in politics and society, and we start questioning, are our politics okay? Are our American government okay? And it's something that we don't really see in horror as much. We see in other movies political it's political discussion, but we don't see it as much in horror. But we really start seeing that, especially in Jordan Peele movies, and we see that as well in The Purge, especially with future Purge movies such as Purge Election Day, which involves politics so much that it became super controversial. So yeah, it's very interesting to see that we shifted away from, you know, just using ghosts only as a scare factor to using the world around us. It can involve anyone, even kids, as we see in It. And it's just interesting to see how much horror has changed over the decade. But we did have a lot of successful movies. If I didn't name your movie, I'm sorry, I can't go through all the horror movies, but these are the ones that really caught my eye, and that I've also enjoyed, I've seen and watched and loved. So I hope that you go through this list and rewatch the movies as the decade comes to a close and just think back at like, oh, horror, like I remember when that movie came out, it scared me, or oh, I remember this film and how, you know, how it changed the horror genre. So one movie that just came out recently was Parasite, a South Korean film, and it basically discusses the whole idea of greed and class discrimination. We see two clans of families who are formed by a symbiotic relationship, and that just creates all these different issues and problems between the family. And it's between the wealthy Park family and the destitute Kim clan. So we get this idea of what wealth and what like all these like social status can do to people and how it could affect their mind. So it's just very interesting. We once again get into that whole political agenda, which we've seen in past movies. So yeah, it's a really interesting movie. It just came out and I recommend it to you guys. It's still in theaters if you guys are interested. So yeah, now we're going to get into how horror has changed. So there's no more ghosts being involved. It can involve anyone, not just adults, but children as well. And anyone can be affected, not just people living in a haunted house. It introduces elements in the outside world in our senses. It gave a reboot to 80s and 2000s horror elements, like It having comedy horror, which hasn't been seen since like the Scary Movie franchise. And we involve politics and society. We start rethinking about our politics and our society as a whole, how people are treated. We see that with the Jordan Peele movies. We see that with The Purge, especially with the movie Purge Election Day. And we see that as well with Parasite and the family clan. So yeah, this was just like a long list of horror films throughout the decade. I'm sorry if I didn't name your personal favorite. I just can't go through all the horror films. I completely recommend anyone to watch any of these films because they're all really good. My personal favorite is Train to Busan, just because I really love the zombie outbreak idea. So yeah, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been Cryptic Delphic with Mel, and stay safe as always.
Hi guys, this is Signe, and welcome back to Climate Conversation. I'm here again with Isabel Gigi, whose voice you surely know by now.
Hello, everybody.
So this is our final segment of Climate Conversation, and I thought it would be interesting to look at what the climate has really been through in the last decade, which is a lot, but try to focus more on the positive aspects of the kind of things that we've achieved in the last decade and where we're going from here and the goals that we have, the goals that the UN has, and how we can sort of work towards these things individually.
Just briefly, Signe, you said it's the last episode. I assume you mean of this season, right?
Yes, of this season, yes.
So you're looking more for to come. A successor to take yes. over your segment next semester.
Yes. Is Ivani going to be here?
Yes. She will. We're going to try and get her on board.
That would be excellent.
So tell us the good news.
Well, we'll start with just the news. First one is good, though. Well, good and bad. The Welsh government has declared a climate emergency. Obviously, a climate emergency is not good, but they've developed a 5-year blueprint to tackle climate change in Wales. The movement is called Prosperity for All. And Wales has set out plans to improve things like flood defenses and secure water supplies and just a whole vast array of other environmental improvements.
Is there a recent development that triggered that declaration of a crisis?
I don't think in Wales specifically. I think that, well, a lot of governments are taking action right now just because there was a report that was released recently, basically saying that we're closer to the tipping point than we really think we are, meaning there's this thing called the production gap report. And that showed that the amount of oil, gas, and coal that countries already plan to produce will lead to 50% more fossil fuels produced by in 2030 than that would allow us to stay under the 2 degrees Celsius warming. So I think a lot of people have sort of realized that and are taking more concrete measures towards their own individual countries.
Who puts together the production gap report? Is it the IPCC?
It could be. To be honest with you, I'm not completely sure who puts it together, but every year they release the carbon report, the production gap report. It's basically just, I've forgotten what the name of it is, but it is just an international organization that basically teams with scientists and tries to make this information as public and accessible as possible.
Okay. And this is the 2 degree warning. This is in reference to the COP21 markers
yes.
that were set in Paris in 2015, right?
Yeah. Yep. 2015, 2016. I think it was, I can't remember exactly which year it was signed.
Yeah. And that was also, that it was in 2015. And even at the time, 2 degrees Celsius was seen as, to some people, it was seen as this huge goal that was insurmountable. And to others, it was seen as not drastic enough, especially to people from island nations
who are actually suffering.
At 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is at the point where even, 4 years after 2015, now here we are in 2019, is that a lot of island nations are seriously seeing the effects of these, of climate change. It's hard to, I think we're pretty removed here in a city. Obviously, we smell pollution and things like that. But there's a little island in Alaska. It's in the Bering Strait. It's basically about 300 people live there. And they live on permafrost, but the permafrost is melting. So their island is literally melting into the sea. And these people are actually starting to move and figure out where to go. So I think it's hard for governments to really recognize or be able to feel and experience the things that people are going through in terms to the how quickly things are warming up. It's quite scary.
So just for reference, the production gap report is produced by the UN Environment Program.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. What else do you have?
Last piece of news for now. John Kerry, who's the former senator and secretary of state, has formed a new bipartisan coalition of world leaders, military, brass, Hollywood celebrities, basically just any important person you can think of to push for public action on climate change. So it's called World War Zero. I tried to really understand that reference. I think it's sort of like a World War III, but it's a new type of world war against climate change, something of that sort.
But zero hour terminology for saying this is when we take off, this is when it happens.
Oh, I've never heard that, but it makes sense.
I guess. Yeah, the ultimate crisis, perhaps.
Yeah. So it's basically World War Zero is meant to win over all the people who are skeptical of the policies to stop carbon emissions by 2050. So all the people who basically thought that these 2 degrees Celsius was totally radical and unattainable.
I think that's a very interesting statement about our time, that a politician would make the effort to reach out to public figures who are not in any sector related to the environmental crisis, and that he would engage Hollywood stars in this effort. I think that says a lot about
the way we consume and the way we...
Yeah.
It's also interesting because I think it's really difficult to change people's behavior with information. And here we are trying to give you information, but people sort of operate within their own little realms and have their own individual influencers. So that could be, you know, Kylie Jenner, if that's someone that you look up to, or it could be Greta Thunberg, or it could be like your local church pastor. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about once you get people's individual influencers involved in a greater cause, I think it's more effective than just...
Okay, go John Kerry.
Go John Kerry.
That was unexpected.
Yeah. So in the last decade, obviously there have been some pretty awful things that have happened in terms of climate change. We've seen, obviously, we're at this tipping point now, which is really bad. Trump isn't so keen on protecting national forests. It's also not a great thing. Trump won the presidency. Don't know if I should impart my political agenda here. But
also, yeah, stripping the national parks, which are a huge, huge part of the American, how do you say, patrimoine, or the culture, the legacy of the U.S.
Yeah.
And all of opening them up to drilling.
Yeah. And now there was, I think earlier this year, they, he wanted to drill in the Arctic, somewhere in the Arctic Ocean, and that was that was objected. But he has unfortunately had access to a lot of other national parks, particularly in indigenous regions, which really sucks too, because people just don't really think about the what people, indigenous people, know about climate change in general. It's super powerful knowledge.
And also rolling back your regulations. So that's always
It's always a bit of
it's always the first to go, it seems.
Yeah.
Power changes hands in the US.
Certainly.
But anyway.
In terms of some good things in the past decade that we've done, obviously the Paris Agreement signed in 2015. I'm sure everyone is familiar with it, but if you're not, it was an agreement within the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, dealing particularly with greenhouse emission mitigation, so stopping or lowering greenhouse gases, adaptation and finance, and it was signed by 97 countries. And in a global scale, that's obviously every country on board would be good, but it's pretty excellent that that amount of people and that amount of leaders sort of have a global consensus of the severity of the issue.
And especially because we were all, I mean, as American citizens, at least, we were all very concerned. And I think globally, people were concerned about Trump's rise to power and what that would mean, not just for other international norms, like policies on human rights and so on, but also for the environment. And when Trump threatened to pull out of the Paris Accord, as soon as he got into office, people around the world were shocked, but also, I think, assuaged to see that so many countries took action on their own and decided to band together and stick to those goals anyway. So now that he's officially withdrawn the U.S. from that accord, because I think it was a 2-year wait time or something like that.
Yeah, he did officially. Recently. It was earlier this year, wasn't it, that it was the official withdrawal?
A few weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's heartening to see that the rest of the world is staying together, at least on this one issue.
Yeah.
So I guess that is one of the positive trends from this past decade.
Yeah, and also, this is more in the past year or so, but there's been a huge influx of climate marches, which really started with Greta Thunberg, but a lot of individual marches too, and people creating conservationists and environmental movements and protests. And I really think this has been the year that people have, well, I think people have always recognized it as an issue, but it's just,
it's really taken off this year.
It's really taken off, and it's almost become a trend, which is awesome. Normally, you know, like trends catch, I don't know, bandwagons catch on to anything, but I think if you're going to bandwagon on anything or choose something to get into, this would be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, in Paris, there was a huge climate rave in March.
Yeah.
And then just a few weeks ago, again, there were, what is the name of this?
The Extinction Rebellion.
The Extinction Rebellion. Yeah.
Yeah. So, especially with youth too, because youth are really the ones that have probably the biggest, you know,
stake
and responsibility. Not to say that older people don't also have responsibility, but yeah, it's cool to see that the people of the next generation are educating themselves so much and sticking up for protection and regulation. And I guess going off of that, it's also interesting. And like, look at what the beginning of this decade was, what, 2010? So if we look at the technology between 2010 and now, how much that's increased, especially in relationship to circulating climate change data and knowledge, is pretty awesome. Like, you can just as easily look up the production gap report, or, I don't know, in simpler terms, how much carbon are we emitting? And that data is pretty much just as accessible as the weather now, which is pretty cool and super important.
And there's more opportunity for crowdsourcing, for open discussion on the internet.
A lot of schools, particularly in the U.S., have started integrating climate change knowledge into their curriculum. Like, I remember, I don't know what it was like for you in elementary school, but we had science once a week. And I think the class was less than an hour. And I think it was sort of earth science based, but it was sort of like walk in the woods and look at rocks type of things. And it wasn't like, hey, this is climate change. This is what we're going to look like in 10 years. And they're starting to do that now, which I think it's just super important to plant that little seed in kids' heads.
Absolutely. Because that was planted in me from a very young age.
Yeah.
In elementary school, I lived in Switzerland and we went to an international school. But I remember in the second grade already learning about reuse, reduce, recycle, and learning about the hole in the ozone layer. I remember that when I was learning to type and browse the internet and learning about the ozone hole.
Yeah, I actually remember learning about that too. I didn't really think it was connected to climate change. I just thought it was like this crazy phenomenon that there could somehow be a hole in space.
But it's absolutely important to get them when they're young, because I remember when Greta Thunberg started gaining attention and I first listened to an interview The Guardian had done with her, and I was blown away. I was so moved because it resonated so deeply with me, her manner of speaking about the crisis. Mm-hmm. Because I remember thinking when I was six, okay, if I know this, if we're learning about this in school right now, that means the adults are acting on this because they already have the information, because they have all the information, of course. And it was just extremely frightening to grow up and to see as we moved along that that wasn't really...
It's just pushed aside.
Yeah. So I agree. This year has been big for the conversation on climate.
Yeah. I really hope that continues and that it almost becomes a necessity to have this in the curriculum, just as important as it is to learn algebra.
If you're just tuning in, this is Climate Conversation on AEP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:40. I think it is.
Yeah. Probably, if not more, to be honest. I mean, I hate math and I hate algebra.
A little bias here. But it's our planet, so.
Yeah. But yeah, as you said, the conversation on climate's been huge this year. And I think the biggest thing is that there's just been a massive global consensus that there's something wrong and that we need to do things to fix it. Mm-hmm. So looking into the next decade, I guess it's just a matter of what we can do as individuals to actually make those things happen.
And speaking of individuals and the next decade, Signe, I know you're graduating this month.
Yes,
so I am. Would you care to share what you have planned next or any ideas you have for the future?
Ideas for the future. I'm sort of in a very limbo stage of my life right now. I'm not really sure what's going to happen, but that's sort of where I'm sort of trying to direct myself, is really into the field of science communication and science literacy.
That's and, really cool.
Yeah, it could be here, it could be in Australia, it could be remote. I have no idea yet. But
so for the listeners who want to keep tuning in with Signe, she will stay on the air somehow, somewhere.
Yes.
We'll pass on those details next semester at the start of the next season of Climate Conversation.
Yeah.
Do you have any final point, Signe?
I guess my final point is just that, just again with the idea of going into this next decade of 2020, there are certainly negatives and a steep curve of change that needs to be followed really closely in order to avoid the complete collapse of ecosystems and all these other problems that are going to happen if these targets aren't reached. But I think the most important thing to think of going into this decade is the individual choices kind of that we've been covering every week for the past couple months or so. So things as simple as being active in local and international politics, your choices on voting, making sure you look at the politicians and what their stance on environmental policies are, green transportation,
how you eat,
eating less meat, all things like that. Yeah, because it's really, and I think everyone says this, but it's just really important to recognize that what you do as an individual is not, it's not just a small choice. It really does. I think it's called the hummingbird effect. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you'd heard of it, but when everyone does the same thing, it really can be huge.
Monumental.
Yeah, monumental.
So on that note, we'll wrap up. And thank you to all the listeners for tuning in with Signe and Ivani this semester on Climate Conversation. And thank you so much, Signe. I knew I just tapped you on the shoulder 2 weeks into the semester and asked you to do this, but
no,
I'm really glad you did, because you did an excellent job.
No, thank you. Yeah, it's really been wonderful. And I've really, really loved doing this and doing Climate Conversation and speaking about this stuff, because it's actually sort of, I think in a way it's helped me really find my niche and something that I'm really interested in doing, and especially with radio and podcasting, because it's such an interesting way to be able to reach a huge amount of people and backgrounds and literacy levels and languages. So Go Radio, and I'm excited to see what's next.
Go Signe.
Climate Conversation.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Jackson with A Taste of Home. I'm here with Fiona.
Yeah, I'm the deputy producer here at AEP Radio, and happy to be here to talk about home and, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. So today we're going to be talking about Christmas or like holiday season or really anything that's kind of like a festive holiday spirit. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Like, where are you from?
So, you know, I guess this is the typical AEP kid answer, but like, I'm not really from one city in particular. I mean, I was born in Houston, moved around a lot throughout Texas and the Northeast. So, and then my family split up around the world, sort of. So, but like, I'd say like with the predominant British influence. So I have a lot of weird amalgams of like home or conceptions of home. So, yeah.
So what kind of like takes you back to like that like childhood moment where you're sitting down, you're like, you eat something, you're like, oh, like this is what home tastes like.
You know, there's like those little fruit marzipans that you can get. I think there's one at La Mère de Famille and some other places like that. My grandmother would always get those from her relatives who ship them over from Newcastle, and she would lay them out on the table, and I would always go and steal more than I needed to. And that really particularly brings me back. So I walk by and I see those, I'm like, oh my God, I can just see her house in Houston. And it's funny because she's, you know, she has this very Queen's English accent. So I'd be like hearing her scold me, and yeah, but yeah.
That's incredible. Have you ever made marzipan by yourself?
No. Oh my God, no. That would it'd be really cool, but like, I don't know if I have the discipline for that, but yeah.
So like what's that like moment where you like sit down and you like open it and like you eat it? Like what's that like image that you have? Like the
So the image that I have is in her front room in her, and so she moved twice again and we were in Texas, and I remember she had this like painting on the wall of these mountains from Santa Fe, and I remember just like opening it and like smelling the marzipan for the first time. You know, it's that really slick, or not slick, it's a very warm smell in a way. I mean, if you can apply that term to it, but
like spicy, like not spicy, but like with like spices, like yeah, aromatic a little bit,
but it's just really rich, but it's a subtle richness that hits you very slowly, and then all of a sudden you're absorbed into the flavor, and yeah, you get this like fantastic sensation, because it's not overly sweet. It's got that little bit of bitterness that I really love in anything. Of course, now I'd enjoy it with an espresso, but back then I just ate it as it was. But yeah, I think that's like the image that I have. I guess a more interesting point for food that would take me home is definitely Mexican food.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. I absolutely love it. But unfortunately, you can't really find that great Mexican food here in Paris.
The funniest thing to me is the spice. I mean, of course, being a Southern girl, I'm like, I love my spice. I have to have the most spicy thing possible. Like, if I'm not crying, it hasn't done its job. So,
yeah. It's so true. And it's unfortunately the spicy tolerance here is not very high. Mm-hmm. I remember taking my Spanish friend. I made Mexican food myself, and he was crying. I'm like, but you're Spanish. He's like, yeah, but like not like Mexican Spanish, like Spain Spanish. It's different. Mm-hmm. I was shocked. But I think Latino food, especially like South American, like Central American, like Latino food is so different from what Europeans think it is.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, I grew up speaking Spanish and English. Even though my grandmother's British, she spoke Spanish with me. But so I learned Castilian Spanish. And it'd be really funny because I go out and I'd be speaking Castilian Spanish in like San Antonio. And they'd be like, ¿Por qué tú tienes una accent como eso? And I'd be like, I'm sorry. I just, you know, I have that. But yeah, no, like all the food that you get from like I had a great influence from Chilean food and Colombian food, because a lot of my friends are from Colombia, and then a lot of different types of Mexican food. But of course, if you go to California, there's like, they sometimes have, it's slightly more mild, but then like in Texas, they really go heavy on the spice. And then I've got a cousin whose family is Cajun. And so then you have that as well. Mm-hmm. So there's like the different variations.
That's incredible. Back,
you know?
What for you is that like quintessential, like Tex-Mex? Like what's that one dish that really kind of unites the two?
I'd have to say, I mean, there's so many like little individual pieces, but like a single unifier would be queso fundido for me from Torchy's Tacos in Austin, Texas. It is the best ever. Or there's this other restaurant called Chewy's, and that really just, there's not one particular dish, but the restaurant itself incarnates the amalgam of Tex-Mex because it's got kind of like this old Hollywood vibe mixed with a lot of pieces that you find at a mercado or something like that in Mexico. So I really love it. But yeah, I mean, it's got the craziest atmosphere.
When you make Mexican food, like, what's your go-to dish to, like, kind of share your culture or, like, your kind of, like background with someone?
Usually because, so I'm vegan and, you know, there's...
I understand that.
there's, like, a lot of things, like, I can't make or use or anything. So, of course, when I say queso fundido, I'm like, yeah, I'm, like, watching people eat it because, like, I can't. But I remember eating it as a kid. What I usually do is I... fry avocado in and if you get it like crispy enough, and it's just makes the best tacos in the world. And then you get it with some lime and black beans and corn and a little bit of red onion, garlic, cumin, chili powder. So I tend to make tacos like that, so some vegan tacos or yeah, I mean, it is difficult for me to think about other stuff because a lot of the materials that I use in the States for veganism, I can't find here, like a lot of good cheeses and stuff that are...
I had the same problem. I had to give it up for parts of a while. Like here, it's very hard to truly be vegan. And especially Oatly, one of my favorite milks, is not here. However, they're bursting the market, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I feel like I have to go to England to get all of my vegan food. I mean, Un Monde Vegan and the Marais is pretty good. I mean, but they have like a limited selection, but I appreciate them nonetheless. But
coming back to like Mexican food, I think there's like such a quintessential like sour taste that comes with it. Like it maybe not sour, but there's always that like citrusy like thing that kind of ties the dish together. And I think that's not really found in that many different... the other cuisine I can think of is Iranian. That kind of has like sour, like pickled onion, like citrus, kind of bites it, like a bite, like it
gives to it. Yeah, like I don't think you could have like a lot of Mexican dishes if you don't have like the lime there to add that extra little burst of flavor. Yeah, there's definitely like that emphasis on that because you have like the really, I guess you'd say like the heavier side of the meal, then you have that and that kind of brings you out of it. And, yeah, really mediates it.
I think it really is like the amalgamation of the climate that really kind of affects the food. With the, it's perfect for growing like limes, lemons, grapefruits and oranges, all of Mexico. And I think it really kind of translates into the food. The first time I ever saw someone make a brine with oranges was my Mexican friend. And I've never seen anything similar to that. I would never put citrus on a bird, but I thought it would like be like acid. It would like dissolve the bird, like dissolve the muscle. But it was very interesting to see that kind of like cultural phenomenon of using acidity.
And then I think like in Texas, we either brine everything with like citrus like that, or we do it all in like beer, or we barbecue it, or like, you know, we just smother it. We're like, you know what? Let's get an open flame. You can put anything over an open flame.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, like when I'm walking around Paris, that's the other thing that reminds me a lot of home is I used to go camping a lot. And I love camping, like full on. You're out in the wilderness. There's nothing there to protect you from those rattlesnakes and those. You know, I mean,
coming from Virginia is very different. Experience usually bears.
Wait, where are you from?
Oh, I'm from Virginia. It's Appalachian Mountains. It was where I did all my camping, and it, again, barbecued.
Yeah,
but so much different from Texan barbecue. All of the South has its different way of barbecuing. Each little like county is like, our barbecue is the best. And I mean, you really can't compare barbecue. It's also good.
Yeah, no, you really can't. Like if you're in Austin, you cannot fight with somebody from Houston or from Lubbock or from Fort Worth or anything like that. But yeah, interestingly enough, I lived in Vermont for 2 years in Burlington, and this is a while ago, and we went to this barbecue restaurant, and my mom actually made the waiter cry. Because she told him to take back the food because it was so burnt. Because she was like, "This isn't how we do it in Texas." And she didn't mean to, but like he was back there like crying. And then I had class with him the next year.
Oh no!
So it was kind of awkward, but Texans have very definitive opinions on their their food.
Oh, absolutely, I love going to the barbecue like competitions and everything. I only went to them once, but it's the variety that you have there in sauce, like how you prefer the meat. It really comes down to kind of like where you're from and how you think it's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's wonderful. The ability to kind of have a different viewpoint on food, and you can kind of share this with other people. Mm. But all just where you were born.
Yeah. Mm. And another weird thing that I like to tell people is, like at Texas State Fairs, yeah, you have the grossest things imaginable, like fried butter, you know, like deep fried Oreos, all that stuff. But you also have really interesting opportunities like fried scorpions, which are pretty good. I've had two, and you know, it's just like a little crunch. And so it does present these like weird options, but at the same time, they're really just beautiful to go and see. And even if they are like super satirical of how American culture like influences our foods, that it's really like, you know, mass produced and gross, it's still fun to see that there is a culture to it, even though we can satirize when we live so far away.
Even between houses, there's a different culture of food. Like, no person in Texas does barbecue the same way. Virginia the same way. It's even my next door neighbor, they might dry rub before, or they might marinate for an hour versus 2 hours. It's always that different. Kind of how you're raised and how you think it's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's incredible just kind of be able to like show how you make food and how you put your love into it, and how you express yourself through food. Like, I express myself through a little bit of spices. My Indian friend puts too much spice in my taste. I usually end up crying, but it's so wonderful just to taste it.
Yeah. And then I think it almost comes down to being like a semi-religious process in a way. Yeah. Like you're just, you know, you're so involved in the tradition of these actions. And of course, you know, there's so much theory about that, but
I mean, I think food is a religion. It really comes into the way, like, I mean, humans have to do two things to survive: eat and drink and sleep. And that's it. And that's basically that all you need to survive. And food has always been incorporated into religion, from what you can and cannot eat to how you prepare meat with halal or kosher, even to kind of how you prepare recipes.
Yeah.
The idea of like eating the blood of, like eating the body of Christ and drinking his blood as wine is very religious. And I think food is always incorporated somewhat into that.
Yeah. And then I feel like there's always a transubstantiation of intention as well, because like when you're preparing it in like a familial setting, like for Christmas or something like that, like when I know, for example, like when I'm in the kitchen with my grandmother and my mom and everything, you know, there's that atmosphere of communion, and you just you really saturate in that. And
coming from Saturday, where I had a whole after Thanksgiving feast, because unfortunately we don't get the day off on Thursday, for cooking for 5 hours, at the end of it I wasn't even tired. I was just so happy to feed my friends and family around me, that even though I cut myself and blood everywhere, everything was great in the end, just to see everyone like be happy with what was on the table.
What would you say are some quintessential Thanksgiving meals? Because me and my roommates, my friends, were having trouble just coming up with different things, because we were so different.
So different. I was talking to my mom, and she serves coleslaw at Thanksgiving, which everyone's like, that's like a summer, like 4th of July kind of dish. And I kind of missed it this year because I didn't make it myself. So it was unfortunate. But I think stuffing is a big one. I feel like stuffing, like everyone has stuffing, even though there's so many variations upon it. Mm. It just bread, sausage, a butter, and a little bit of chicken broth, and bake it. It's just such a common, at least I believe it, is mashed potatoes as well.
I mean, the turkey, no matter how you do it.
I did duck this year. I couldn't find a turkey.
I mean, and I'm not sure, this might just be a strange Texan thing, but there's a turducken where you put
yes. I scared my French friends with it. I'm like, oh, I'm going to prepare a turducken for you guys. And they're like, I had to explain to what the meal was.
Oh my God.
For those that don't know, it's a turkey stuffed with a chicken, and the duck is stuffed into the chicken. My friend deep fried one year. That was wonderful.
Yeah, welcome to American culture. Go big or go home.
Exactly. And then vegetables is also like seasonally, like all over the U.S. it's so big. Like, some people use, like, potatoes are pretty quintessential, but like carrots and turnips versus butternut squash and pumpkin, it's very different.
Like, when I lived in Massachusetts, and later when I lived in Vermont, again, it was mostly an emphasis on those things. And then, like, in Texas, it's like corn. Thumb with the U.S.
I mean, even the pies and desserts, I mean, it's yam pie versus pumpkin pie. It was versus a big
pecan pie.
Pecan pie, and then cherry, and then apple, and all those. But anyway, I think coming back to the point that food is religion, and it's how we express ourselves, is, I think it's a very, very true sentiment. Well, thank you so much for joining
me. You're welcome. It was really fun.
Mm-hmm. Like, you're talking about God, food, yeah, and Texas.
I mean, I feel weird because I'm an absurdist. I'm like, I don't really like believe in like God or anything, but like, I love the using religion in a commonplace setting because it can be anything. So,
Well, thank you again. This was incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
This was A Taste of Home with Jackson and Fiona.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
AUP Radio is produced by Savannah Rowe, Fiona McMurray, Elise Chauvel, and Isabel Gigi. That's me. Our theme music is by Jill Chavitz and Oliver Henry of Chateau Rouge. That's all for tonight on AUP Radio. Tune in tomorrow for more, and have a great night.